This episode is brought to you by Fetch. Fetch is a kennel alternative right here in Denver, not a traditional doggy daycare or boarding school. They offer one-on-one private pet care for all kinds of pets, both furry and non-furry. And their employees are experienced, insured, bonded, and background checked, so you can rest easy knowing your pet is in good hands. Basically, they know pets. I used to watch a Burmese mountain dog named Sven, who was just like walking a polar bear. It was insane. Fetch offers pet sitting, dog walking, pet taxi, medication administration, and more. And he hated going on walks. I could like walk him around the block and then he was like, he just liked to lay in the bathtub. So if you're looking for high quality pet care you can trust, check out Fetch at northdenver.fetchpetcare.com. That's northdenver.fetchpetcare.com.
Today on CityCast Denver, the governor has called for an investigation into Xcel Energy after the metro-wide blackouts earlier this week. So we're talking about the big picture of climate change, wildfires, and, because it's Friday, all the other local stories that mattered this week, like the brewing controversy over public comments and our Rocky Mountain highs and lows. Today is Friday, April 12th. I'm Paul Caroli, and here's what Denver's talking about. Welcome back to CityCast Denver, the capital of Colorado MAGA, as former President Trump lovingly nicknamed our state after his crowd held a big party at the GOP State Assembly in Pueblo last weekend. It's Friday. We're here in the 5280 Magazine studios. Our host, Bree Davies, is out today, unfortunately, but I've got two amazing guests with me. Our politics and green chili correspondent, Justine Sandoval, is back. Welcome back, Justine.
Thanks for having me. I have to admit, I threw up in my mouth a little when you said Colorado MAGA.
Yeah. When I saw it, I knew we had to talk about it. I don't know why he's so interested in us right now. I think it's because of this Dave Williams dude who's running the party.
Oh, yeah.
Did you watch the festivities around the GOP assembly, Justine?
I mean, I watched the chaos go down on Twitter.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm always watching the GOP. Got my eye on him.
I don't know if they're imploding or if this Williams guy is just like wrenching them into the future in some new direction. Oh. I can't really figure out what's happening.
No, he's a menace.
I know a lot of his colleagues think so.
Yeah.
There's been some calls for him to resign this week after the incident with him removing the journalist.
Yep. He's definitely not a uniter when it comes to the party, which is what the Republican Party really needs right now in Colorado. They need to coalesce around something that's not Trump, because that's actually more of a divisive situation right now amongst them. And yeah, ejecting Sandra Fish, who's like one of the most straightforward, fair journalists.
100%.
Journalists. And, you know, what are we doing? Like, that is so fascist.
Outrageous.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. We'll see when the primaries are happening in June. We'll see what happens with, you know, what conservative Coloradans want out of this party, I guess. Anyway, joining us also for the very first time, an old podcast pal of mine. She's got a PhD in geography with a special focus on global climate policy and carbon markets. And she's now at CSU helping teach the next generation of climate justice warriors. Lauren Gifford is here. Welcome,
Hi,
Lauren.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me. This is awesome.
Lauren, how about you? Have you been watching this drama with the GOP?
Yeah, but I do think there is this problem where sort of more leftist and progressive folks sleep on the GOP and then Trump gets elected president.
It's happened before,
it's
after
happened
all.
Before, and it might happen again. So I think we can't dismiss them as chaotic and, you know, disorganized. We have to sort of organize ourselves a little bit better as well.
And figure out really what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, we'll be working on that, but that's not our topic today. And actually, before we get into our big top story this week, I have something very exciting to share. Wine Spectator's Grand Tour is coming to the Sheraton in beautiful downtown Denver on May 11th, and we want to see you there. But here's the thing. This event is kind of exclusive. So here's what we're going to do. We've got some discount codes for $100 off the tickets, but it's only for our members. And we're going to tell all of our members on Monday. So if you want a discount to a hot new wine event coming to Denver, you got to sign up to become a member right now, or at least before Monday. But also, The nice people at Wine Spectator have hooked us up with a couple of VIP tickets, which retail at $375 a pop. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to give them away to the fifth person who joins as a new member the day this episode drops, which is Friday, April 12th. That's a $750 pair of VIP tickets. And all you got to do is be the fifth person to join as a member. And this event sounds cool. They got like 240 hand-picked wines. You can meet the winemakers. I've heard from our chief revenue officer, Michael, that this is just an incredible event. I think it's the first time it's going to be happening in Denver. So this is your chance to go do something really awesome, courtesy of your friends at CityCast. So head on over to membership.citycast.fm and sign up today and get a chance to win those ticks and get a discount to this cool event. All right. Let's get into our top story this week, which is the wind. As of Wednesday, Governor Jared Polis is calling for the Public Utilities Commission to investigate Xcel Energy and the outages that left tens of thousands of people across the Denver metro area without power, some for days after the windstorm last weekend. Lauren, I want to start with you. This is why I was excited to talk to you today. Why did the power go out?
Well, I don't think we actually know exactly why the power went out for real.
Okay, really?
But the argument is that, or Xcel's reasoning is that one of their downed power lines contributed to the start of the Marshall Fire in Louisville and Superior, where I live, where 1,000 homes were lost, 2 people lost their lives. I mean, it's one of the most catastrophic urban, rural, or urban wildfires in the country.
People are still rebuilding.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's empty lots all over Louisville still. It was a catastrophic incident in our community. So I think there's fear of that. And then there's also been lawsuits against Xcel for their liability in that. And I think that they want to avoid the lawsuits as well. But they turned off power with very little warning, sometimes no warning. The numbers were hard to find exactly, but Polis says it was 155,000 people. And this was for a long time. Some people were without power for 48 hours. Boulder Valley School District couldn't open some of their schools. If your kid can't go to school, you can't go to work. Lots of restaurants lost food, spoiled food.
You were telling me about Hosea Rosenberg at Black Belly Market in Boulder, which is opening a new place here in Denver soon.
Yeah. And I think it actually is open.
Oh, great.
Yes. But their Boulder location, and Hosea is a really well-connected restaurateur. So he was able to get a refrigerated truck to sort of park outside the restaurant, but not all to put the food in so that they had limited spoil. But there was so much spoiled food. Now Boulder County has set up stations where you can discard spoiled food. So restaurants, households, I mean, that's an incredible amount of money for people who are already stretched thin. Food is already too expensive right now for many people.
Yeah, and a huge impact. So they're saying if we had more notice from Xcel, maybe we could have done something about this.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, and I think I mentioned this to you when we were talking on the phone earlier in this week, but I had done my master's research in Cuba and I lived in Havana, Cuba, and there was regularly rolling blackouts.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is a rolling blackout, right? Yeah. This is a rolling blackout for, and obviously there's a risk, like a wildfire risk, but also we've had much more precipitation in the previous few months than we did before the Marshall Fire. And I think that there could have been better calculations into what the risk actually was.
From Xcel,
yeah. Right? I've heard some chatter where people said it felt very spiteful.
Spiteful from Xcel?
Yeah, because, was it coming from communities that sued them? You know, who knows?
Interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's just hearsay, right?
Yeah.
But it's, they're protecting themselves. But part of this risk comes from the deferred maintenance that Xcel has not, taken up on their own infrastructure in decades, right?
Yeah.
Like these lines are failing because they haven't invested in them. And before I came here, I was just doing some reading to learn more about Xcel. Does anyone want to guess the executive compensation of Xcel's CEO in the last year or so?
Justine, you want to take a crack at that?
Is it over $1 million?
Oh my gosh, Justine. Oh my gosh.
Are we talking Xcel Colorado, Robert Kenny?
Yeah.
No, it's Xcel.
Xcel National?
National. So it's four states. He's got four states.
Then definitely over $1 million. I thought maybe...
Maybe a million. I don't know. I have no idea. $750,000 a year.
Oh, come on, Paul.
That's my real guess.
That's what like a university president makes. He estimates that I saw were between $8 and $21 million a year.
What?
A year. So base pay is something like $1.9 million, but then he gets all this extra pay.
Yeah.
Imagine if some of that had been reinvested in infrastructure updates in fire-prone regions.
Or at the very least, to hire someone to send some emails, you know, 36 hours before they shut off the power. Like, hey, just by the way, we're planning this.
Yeah.
Justine, what was your experience of this windstorm?
Well, you know, I thought the wind had shut the power off from what I was first seeing.
Mm-hmm. I did too.
Yeah, there was that. That's why it was the 155,000 as well, because it was also down power lines from the wind, but then it was also the shutoff that happened too. So it was doubly bad for everybody in the situation. But, you know, I think looking at this, you know, the Marshall Fire really highlighted the urgency in reevaluating wildfire prevention strategies. And so I think people are on board with, you know, things like de-energizing power lines when it's necessary. But the rollout, like, was just so terrible. And as someone who, like, works in community outreach and, like, the communication side with people, you know, there was just, like, a complete lack of effort. And, like, to mention the compensation for the CEOs, like, you would think that an energy company would be so invested in that outreach team. Like, no press release went out that we're possibly thinking of turning off the power for 55,000 people. That's kind of mind-blowing. They're, like, it should have been a whole communication strategy when they decided Friday at 6 o'clock that they were probably going to shut off the power the next day to get that information out. But beyond that, it should have been even before. There should be discussions and warnings to people that, hey, this might be something that we're going to be doing in the future. So how can you better prepare for blackouts? And, you know, as the climate becomes more, you know, climate issues are right at our front door and fires are coming right into our communities, we have to, like, prepare for a future where you might have blackouts and you might have these situations. So, you know, for Xcel not to do any of that preemptive work, to not communicate well enough, or even communicate, it seems like, with the state to say, hey, this is something that's going to impact public health. This is going to impact businesses. We were talking about throwing away food. Boulder County Food Bank had a throwaway food this week.
Well, like, I saw that one and I thought I have some personal experience on that particular subject. I worked at a food bank for a summer. My whole job was throwing away food because they just didn't have the big enough freezers and they got way more donations than they needed. So throwing away food was like an everyday thing. I think it's probably a different scale in this particular situation. But when I saw that, I was like,
But like the waste treatment plant situation.
There was no conversation
with like these very important facilities that could cause a hazard and contaminate our water to say, hey, we're going to shut off the power.
You're like, totally right about this. Like the fact that this preemptive shutdown has never happened before in Colorado, and then we're only learning that this is even a possibility after the fact, that's a big problem.
And it's something that's going to happen more frequently, right? And that's what they're saying. And it's like, why don't we invest in enhancements in this infrastructure instead of saying this is the new normal and this is the new reality? Climate change means more unpredictable weather patterns and more severe weather events. And if this is the response from our public utility, that's really scary, right? Like, I mean, just even small examples, right? We've been talking about sort of community scale or, you know, municipality scale, but like my friend couldn't cook food for her kids for 2 days, right? Like many people couldn't, but they came over my house and we were like, we'll cook for you. My friend's mother was recovering from a knee replacement and had to spend 2 days, you know, post-surgery without power and she couldn't move. So this has a lot of implications for people's physical and mental health as well.
Lauren, you talked about deferred maintenance and these rolling blackouts earlier. I wonder if we could like tell us more about that big picture. Like, how is climate change going to connect with those infrastructure issues? I'm just having a hard time sorting it all out. Help me understand.
Yes. So that's a huge question. If you'd like to write a doctoral dissertation on it, I'd love to be your advisor. we could spend 5 years on it.
Cool. Yeah.
But I think, you know, a couple of things that made me, that I started thinking about in this space was Xcel is actually getting their energy from a really diversified portfolio of energy sources. So there's several coal-fired power plants here in Colorado. They also use renewables. They use biomass. Like, it's hydrogen, you know, gas. So, and they will be decarbonizing progressively over the next. I think they want to be, you know, carbon neutral by 2050 or something like that. So there's a big shift in where that energy is coming from. But I think what we were experiencing was the actual infrastructure that takes it from the source and distributes it to homes. You know,
yeah,
these like
above, what people call the grid.
Exactly. This is above ground. Mm-hmm. And the technology is simply outdated in some ways. It hasn't been updated. You know, it hasn't been updated. If wind can knock it out, we need to find a better way because we're going to have more intense wind.
Mm.
And this isn't a way to live in a region that wants to bill itself as like the new tech hub, right? Like the Silicon Valley of the West. Like you can't have power out in the whole Front Range when there's a windstorm and also be the center of innovation for the region.
Yeah, it's just a huge economic implications.
Yeah.
It's not just the mom and pop shops who are struggling for a day or two. Mm-hmm. It's the whole economy that's
right.
going to be affected.
And you know what? As in everything, the most privileged people won't feel that impact. They'll have generators on their homes, right? So it's the people who can't afford a $15,000 generator on their home or generators in their office in downtown Boulder, right? It's everyone else, and that's mostly everyone, you know?
Hmm. Justine, I want to talk to you about the politics of this situation, because Governor Polis, he called for the Public Utilities Commission to investigate Xcel. And I think the PUC is what, they're the regulator for Xcel. But what are you seeing in the politics here? What's important to you?
Well, you know, I think it was necessary for the governor's response was necessary considering like the implications of the shutdown and, you know, like the public health, all the other issues that can really impact people's day-to-day life, people getting home care, all of those things. But yeah, if you look at what he asked the PUC to investigate, it's like stuff that I would assume Xcel would have had in place already. So, you know, I think this oversight is necessary because obviously it's not there, because you could see how this situation went down this weekend. So there really needs to be some oversight and there needs to be some investigation. And the things that they asked to look for are just very straight up things that should have already been, I think, done by Xcel.
Hmm. Although I wonder, I mean, I have to think about the other side, like Xcel is going to look at this investigation. They're going to look at this increasing scrutiny and they're going to think that's going to cost money.
Oh, yeah. I saw a lot of public commentary. People are like, they're probably going to charge us extra now for all of this because, you know, the infrastructure issue. They're like, we're going to have to fix these things. That's why we had to do it. So now we're going to increase your fees, or this is why your summer cooling bill is outrageous.
Cost is always going to trickle down to the users.
Yeah.
And that's really disturbing when it comes to things like a public utility.
Yeah,
it is.
And then you wonder, is it really public? You know?
Yeah. Or what happens in the summer, too? You know, we had this situation now. Luckily, it wasn't, you know, freezing cold either, because that's a whole other element. But in the summer when it's hot, you know, and we have, you know, vulnerable groups that need to make sure that they have air conditioning. Like, what do we do? Like, this is going to be an ongoing issue. And I think it's something that Xcel really needs to check themselves on, because this did not go over well.
It sure didn't. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it. We're going to go to a quick break and we're going to talk about more news. And we're back. Our hot topic this week is the comment section, because increasingly in the realm of local politics, the chat is blowing up. Westward reported this week that Denver City Council is considering changes to the way they hear public comments after protesters disrupted council proceedings 3 times in the last 6 months. And then also this week, there was news that former school board member Ayante Anderson and Denver Public Schools have settled a lawsuit over Anderson's decision to block a DPS parent from his Facebook page last July. Justine, I want to start with you. We've talked about Director Anderson quite a bit on the show. What do you think about that $25,000 settlement? Over a block.
I know. It's the new era we're living in, right? Like, Facebook, social media has been like this huge new issue when it comes to our elected officials and how they communicate with their constituents. And there'd been this conversation a while ago, I think, with a state legislator about blocking, and then it was determined you can't block your constituents. So
yeah, they have this whole new law.
Yeah. And so I think this happened after all of that too. But you know, if it's a risk too when you're engaging as an elected official with the public back and you're not able to block people. So it's always a risk, and that high engagement can create tension, I think, and it can get people into trouble.
If a politician asks you for advice, like how do I approach the internet right now? What would you say?
I would say, you know, use that type of engagement as more of a one way to let your constituents talk directly to you and maybe not engage that way back, and or be
you're
very
saying,
strategic.
Don't mix it up with the trolls.
No, I think, you know, state, you have to, as much as it's not as fun to be on the internet when you can't just totally troll back, you as an elected official, you have this elevated expectation to not do that. And so I think my advice would be not to engage in that type of social media activity. You have your personal account, you have your elected official account, and I think it's good to keep those separate. And if you really have to, I mean, create a secret troll account, and so you can get all of that urge out, because stuff like this will happen and it's risky. I mean, part of like why I would be reluctant to become elected official is because I want to block any weirdo that's coming after me. I want to like your mom them or whatever, but you cannot do that, you know, because if you're an elected official, you're held to higher standard, I think.
I think don't respond, right? Yeah. This was actually advice given to me by a pretty well-known scientist, actually. He said,
really?
I never respond to on Twitter. Just don't respond. But I think also you can hire someone to run your social media and then you don't even see it.
Yeah. No, that is actually great advice, too. Yeah.
Justine, you mentioned burner accounts. You haven't heard of any politician, local politician with a burner account, have you?
Well, I will not name names, but you know, it's been known to happen.
So somewhere in the comment section, maybe Mayor Mike Johnson is quietly
that I do not know specifically,
putting people on blast.
But I would not be surprised if some very well-known elected leaders have burner accounts here.
You know, this was a plot line on Real Housewives of Salt Lake City this season.
Oh, yes. Really? What happened?
Monica, thank you, Justine. Monica turned out to be the troll account Reality Von Tees, who trolled the other women on the show and like posted things about them. And you know, I'm saying this like tongue in cheek, but also this is like how people interact right now. And the internet and these social media platforms create space, even Zoom, right, for these public meetings, these public hearings that have been like Zoom bombed. They create space between people, and that allows people's worst behavior to come out.
Mm. So I want to read a quote here from Jeffrey Roberts, the executive director of the Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition. This is about the settlement, and it's from a Denver Post article about the settlement. It seems to me that if Anderson's using this for Denver Public Schools business, then that is a public forum. But the legislature has essentially declared it's not. He's referring to that new law where lawmakers are allowed to block people from their private pages. So Roberts goes on, why isn't that a public forum? And can a legislature say it's not a public forum, even if it's used that way? They're talking about private Facebook pages. So I think that's the question, is like, does the public have any right to private Facebook pages if it's a public official?
And Facebook is, you know, what is it, a publicly traded company, right? It's not an open forum. It's not a city council meeting.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all.
Yeah.
But Justine, what do you think?
No, I think that's where like the public-private account comes in, right? And so thinking back to that law, this was Anderson's private Facebook page, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It was.
Yeah,
although he uses it for public purposes.
Right.
Like he has a lot of followers on his private account because he accrued them as he was campaigning and, you know, gaining popularity, and then he got elected. And then he had this public account that had very few followers, so he just continued to use his private account because that was the way to reach people.
Yeah, no, I think one thing you have to do, and I've seen this with other people get elected, is you may already have a large following in your private, but you have to funnel them over in order to maintain that privacy wall. Because your Facebook can be private, your personal Facebook, but if you're trying to maintain that group that you've already amassed, you need to push them over to your public space.
Hmm.
That would be my thought.
My thought is, I hope we can stop talking about Anderson at some point.
Like, oh, yeah?
Just in the public discourse and broadly.
He has dominated a lot of conversations. I was looking at the comment sections on this story, and it was, some people are just really sick of him.
Mm-hmm.
And not in a nice way.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of those people that attracts this kind of attention. I can understand why he would find himself in the middle of a story like this.
Right, exactly. And I think there's so many things going on in DPS right now that deserve attention and energy beyond this. That I wish that all this energy and attention can go to solving some problems for the kids in Denver.
Yeah, it gets difficult. And I think, you know, like you were saying, these type of online arguments you engage in, it brings it right to your front door easily. Mm. And you're able to get into like these types of engagement online that result in these lawsuits. That's why I've kind of like chilled out, because I used to be known for being like pretty, you know, out there online.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You were one of these commenters.
I was like not holding back. Like 2020 broke me. I was like, what? Like fighting online with everybody.
You ever get blocked by an elected?
No. You know, because I kind of walk that line differently because I work with a lot of electeds.
Yeah.
But oh no, wait, who did I get blocked by? I got blocked on the Republican side. I've been blocked.
I imagine.
Yeah. So yeah.
You're
now
like
I think
Governor
back.
Polis.
No,
J-Po. I criticized his shoes too much.
No, he hasn't blocked me for that yet.
That got him into JQ or GQ, didn't they? Like redo his outfit
a
when
few
he was
years
like,
ago,
yeah, before he was governor.
Oh yeah, after he got worse dressed like politician in the country. But we had a point for that. Oh, so you know this. You know, these lawsuits come about. So I try to be quiet because apparently people have lawsuit money to prove points and I don't have anyone to help me pay out that money. So I'm just going to chill out from now on. Like, that's my personal advice to people.
Good for you. I think that's good advice. So let's talk about the bigger issue here. This other side of this is that there are some proposed changes to the way that city councils across the Denver metro are doing public comment. Denver's talking about expanding theirs. There's been some proposals in Aurora and then in Lakewood. They're talking about changing, like shutting down comments on their online pages entirely, because I guess they've gotten quite hostile, which you can imagine. So Westward was reporting on this. What do y'all think about like public comment at city council specifically? Because that's kind of a unique forum. Justine, have you seen this?
Oh yeah, I've seen it go down in city council.
It's kind of fun sometimes. Sometimes it's really interesting.
Oh yeah, it's fun. And you know, I'm an activist, so I'm all about the idea of packing the house and people showing up to get a message across. I think sometimes what happens in city council is that there's this public comment period, but then, you know, there's other business that has to go on in these meetings, like zoning and all of like not so fun stuff, or like not fun, but not so like in the forefront of issues that people really want to talk about.
But the business, activists want to talk about
it. But there's business that needs to go on too. So maybe, you know, we need to find a balance where some of that business can happen, but we also have a longer forum for people to express their opinions to the city council.
Yeah. And some of those ideas, Shannon Hoffman, who ran for city council in the last cycle, she is kind of the one pushing this from my understanding. And so she wants even more access to city council for the public. She's talking about why isn't the council calling special hearings when they notice that there's a big group of people showing up for a public comment? Why isn't council reaching out to organizers for some like community listening sessions? Why isn't that a formal process? Lauren, what do you think about that?
Yeah. So before I was in academia, I was a newspaper reporter. So I've spent many a night in a public hearing. And I've also worked with a lot of civil society groups. Mm-hmm. So I've been on both sides of these discussions. And I think it's really, it's a really challenging conundrum. Because there are what brings these critical masses to these meetings are different things. Sometimes it's to be disruptive, and sometimes it's because people don't feel like they're being heard. And maybe if your constituents don't feel like they're being heard, you need to look inward and say, what is this council doing and how can we do it better? If your constituents, if you're paid by taxpayers to represent constituents, you need to give time and make sure you reflect that you've actually heard what they said.
Yeah. And sometimes apparently it's quite effective. Like some of these council members, there's quotes in this Westward piece, they really like it. Like Paul Cashman, who actually led the effort like 5 years ago to expand public comment. They used to only do it monthly. Now they do it weekly. He says it's not infrequent that we'll be approaching an issue on council and you think you've got your mind made up, and then someone will express an opinion in a different way than you've heard it before, and it plays a role in the decision-making process.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it totally makes a difference. And I tell people that all the time. Your calls, your letters, your testimony does make an impact. And the more people want to speak up, the better. But it is a hard process to get everyone's voice heard. But it's something we have to figure out how to do because it's part of our system. And so I agree with Hoffman here on a lot of this because the state legislature kind of handles it like that. There's a hearing and mm-hmm. public testimony. You can come in and testify. And I've been in there till like 3 a.m. on some of these bills so we can make sure everybody gets heard. And, you know, there's a specified time and that is the, you know, however right. long it takes public commentary. And then there are meetings with stakeholder groups to, you know, get those voices across. And I think that can be probably something the council can kind of implement to help, you know, get those voices heard.
Yeah, I think that's a political choice. I think that's, you know, if I was on council and I wanted to appeal to like these activist groups or maybe the more engaged people, like I would want to make myself more available for public comment. But I think at the same time, they have to be thinking about the majority of people that didn't have time to show up, or maybe don't have as strong of feelings, but probably still do care about these issues, but just are not in public comment. Because you have to represent everybody.
Right, yeah. And this is just a side note, but I was thinking about how dorky everyone on this call or on this podcast is right now on CityCast Denver, because I'm like, I've been to so many council meetings and you're like, I've stayed out till 3 a.m. at a council meeting. And I'm like,
oh. Yeah, I mean, sometimes they're so exhausting. Like if some people just like they'll go up and they'll just drone on and on mm-hmm. and they won't make a point. And it's like, why are we even here for this? And it's frustrating.
Oh, yeah. I've said anti-abortion testimony for hours. And, you know, and a lot of these times it runs the risk sometimes of being abusive. You've had like city council meetings overrun by like anti-Semitic groups recently mm-hmm. where it's like, what's the line between public commentary that's helpful for the good of the process and people there that just want to be abusive and use that as a platform for hate speech as well.
Yeah. There's one other piece of this that I thought was fascinating because it's something that we celebrated after the pandemic. One of the positive changes was public comment sessions went remote and people could call in or Zoom in and offer their comment in these sessions. But in Aurora, Councilman Curtis Gardner is proposing to do away with that and to require in-person public comment, to go back to the old way. How do you two feel about that?
Well, it sounded like part of the reason is because these hate groups are organizing and overwhelming the platform and the time allotted. And that's really discouraging. So I think there is, you know, a reason why they would do that, right? These aren't people from Aurora who are coming in and spouting hateful rhetoric. At the same time, the example they use is like a working mother is home cooking for her kids, but she can still hop on. I wonder how often that really happens.
Yeah.
You know,
me too.
I'm a working mother and I cook dinner for my two kids. And the last thing I want to do is zoom in on public comment after.
You're like, oh, spaghetti's going to be done in 10 minutes. I can call in and, you know, weigh in on some zoning thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think so.
So, you know, I do think sometimes with public governance, you can't win. Not everyone's going to be able to win, and it sucks, but.
Well, I've got an idea for this because
yeah,
I think
us.
We can win. I want to run this by
I love the optimism. Oh, we can win.
Now, normally, and they know this, but I do not like the mods. Mm-hmm. Mods and me, we don't get along. But I think, you know, what if the city of Denver was the first city in the country to elect an independent mod? Someone from the people to moderate public comment specifically. Like this would be their job.
My mother is the moderator of the Bar Harbor Barter and Swap Facebook page in Bar Harbor, Maine.
Oh yeah?
And there's so much drama that just comes up with that.
I believe it.
Yeah,
I believe
so
it.
I can't imagine.
It's a hard job.
It's a hard job. It's a hard job.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think that actually is a great idea. But you would have to pay that person so much money. Mm-hmm. Like, because I was yeah. also the moderator of a Facebook group that blew up and it was dramatic.
Right.
Yeah.
but it is an important job.
Yes.
I mean, you have to have a good mod. Someone of the community, too, mm-hmm. I think is important. So, like, we have an independent monitor for the police that's not affiliated with the police. Like, I think that mm-hmm. would be important. I don't know. Something that I'm thinking about.
There's some masochist out there that would love that job.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take one more quick break here, and we'll be back with Wins and Fails. All right, we're back. Best way to end the week, Rocky Mountain highs and lows, aka wins and fails. Each of us brought a recent local something we think is a win and another we think is a fail, and we're going to talk about them. Let's do fails first so we can end on the good stuff. Justine, you want to take us away?
Sure. My fail was the Village closure. And the Village was a center that provides free food, clothing, mental health support, workforce training, and other important resources to students and their families in six Denver public schools. And yeah, so it was a really great program. And I heard about it when it first started up. It was actually a program that was started with the pandemic money that came in that was earmarked specifically for schools. Mm-hmm. So it was this program to kind of help make up for those resources that were missing. But unfortunately, that money is drying up and they were going to be closing at the end of the school year. But, you know, I just think it's really sad when we have a lot of these programs that really, like, they're called the Village because it takes a village, right? Like, investing in the wellness, especially of our most at-risk students, you know, even just having clean clothes to wear to school can be something that a student is struggling with. So being able to provide these extra resources, mental health resources, is so crucial. And so the program had cost, I think, $700,000 a year, and DPS didn't absorb the cost because they already have some other programs. Hmm. But this program was very specific to the most at-risk students. So it always bums me out to see programs like this, you know, get started up and really good ideas get going with these grant funding, but then has never been able to find long-term, you know, solutions to pay for these really great programs. So fail.
Yeah, that is a shame. That is a shame. It reminds me, we had this conversation earlier this week about gun violence, especially, you know, spiking during the pandemic and going down now, but like this kind of program, people may, we're not maybe funding this, but we could be thinking about this as violence prevention too.
Oh yeah.
Supporting kids.
Everything that we're worried about now in society, you know, we can help. We also have to stop these things from happening by investing in our children now. So. Yeah.
Lauren, you want to give us a fail?
At first, I thought when I first started listening to CityCast, I thought it was wind and sails. And I was like, where's the negative there? This sounds fantastic. Let's go. But my fail is related to wind. It's that it's that Xcel Energy cut off power to dozens of thousands of, or, you know, people in our region, and that this is their go-to solution for our new reality. And we need better. So we have to have something better. And I don't know if that's going to come from the state or Xcel or a partnership of all of it, but we need better.
Clearly the biggest fail of the week. I mean, they earned it. Sometimes mm-hmm. you just have to give it up. Sometimes a fail is something crappy that happened. Sometimes someone face plants, and this week they earned it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my fail this week, kind of a fun one. This comes from Westward food editor Molly Martin, who had just a great story this week. My fail goes to Momofuku founder and celebrity chef David Chang. Did you all see any of the stuff about
yes.
him this week on the internet?
No. I got deep into it on the internet.
This chili crunch situation is fascinating. He's been very litigious.
Oh.
He owns the trademark for the term chili crunch. So that like spicy chili
oil.
Oh,
because Busaba, the Thai restaurant that's in Boulder and Louisville, they have Busaba chili crunch now.
Oh, they have their
they're
own?
Like they're restaurant branded. Yeah.
Do they call it that?
Yeah.
It's the chili crunch specifically, right? That's yeah. the term. Yeah.
Chili crunch. And then, so what's interesting about this story is, Busaba might have to watch out. Apparently, mm-hmm. Chang has been sending cease and desist letters to small, like, mom and pops who sell this stuff, which is just a weird choice for him. Someone who, like, purports to celebrate this exact food culture that he's now undermining. Anyway, the fun connection here for Denver is that Chang bought the trademark from a Denver entrepreneur who initially created this, a different type of sauce, more like Mexican-inspired than Asian-inspired, and was selling it as Chili Crunch for years, who got into their own trademark dispute with Trader Joe's that they won, but then got into another one with Chang, and then it turned out to be so expensive for her that she had to sell the trademark to him. That's how she got it.
Is he the milk bar guy too?
He's the milk bar
guy. He's gonna like trademark birthday cake or something next. Who knows?
Boy, I don't know. What a crazy story though. This whole Chili Crunch trademark situation. Bizarre.
Fail.
Definitely
total
a fail.
Fail.
Time for wins. Who wants to go first? Lauren?
Yeah, I can go first.
Go for it.
My win is small, but it's awesome. Every first Friday, I think from April to October, the Thunderbird Man branch of the Denver Library at 7th and Santa Fe does a paint and sip. So you can sit outside on their lawn. They give you paint and canvases. They have like lights in the trees. Mm-hmm. I've taken my daughter there for the last couple of years. It's always a highlight.
Oh, amazing.
It's during the first Friday art walk, mm-hmm. which in and of itself is awesome. And I've been taking my daughter since she was 4, and it like makes us love Denver's like weird side and just kind of like, let's walk down an alley and see what we find. And we were invited by the Denver Public Library staff to come and paint a couple years ago, and we go regularly, and it's just awesome. And I really recommend people stop by the Thunderbird branch to paint and to sit and paint on first Fridays.
Amazing. I love that. Sounds like a blast. I have to ask you, I assume you were there last Friday mm-hmm. for First Friday. Did you happen to see if there were still protesters outside the Drip Coffee?
They were there.
Okay. Because that's maybe a subsidiary win for me. They've been out there for a long time.
Yeah, years, right?
I don't know. Going up against... So Drip Coffee, if you don't know, we'll put a link in the show notes to the story, but they're owned by like a religious organization that's like anti-LGBTQ. And these protesters have been out there every month.
I mean, there must have been 10 people there this,
amazing.
This week. Yeah.
The persistence to be out there. They just are not letting up. You gotta respect that.
Yeah.
I love a long-term protest.
Oh, yeah.
Justine, you want to give us a win?
Yes, I'm so excited about my win this week. So I've been anticipating this one for a long time, but this last Friday, La Plaza, Colorado opened. It's over off of Colfax and Chambers, so it's in Aurora, but it's an indoor market, and you can get all the Latino products and food, and it's actually a really cool concept that I had been following this project because I used to be a regular at La Esquina del Sabor, which was in the same location of the parking lot. And during the pandemic, when they were starting to build this La Plaza Colorado, it stopped. So a lot of the food truck owners started parking outside, and they created a little market outside. And I was a regular there, and they had so many good food and items. And so this
Amazing.
Opened up now, and it's actually a really cool project because it's bringing together all of these small businesses. Booth rentals are super affordable. Like some of them are $150 to $400 a month.
How does it work? So it's booths. What does it look like if I go inside, do you think?
So from what I haven't seen yet with my own eyes, but on like the pictures I've seen, it's basically just a large, like a mercado you would see like in Latin America, or if you've been to like any of the big markets in like Mexico City where they have like food and items. So smaller stalls and businesses. And the idea is that it's more accessible, especially for smaller businesses trying to start up. So it's really cheap. There's no credit check, and they're 30-day leases. So if your business doesn't work out, yeah, you can go. And it's like this great concept to bring all of these vendors in. And the really cool part is that 54% of the businesses there are all Latina owned. And a lot of them are first-time business owners. So it's super cool. And the last cool thing about it, it's in the old Kmart, which I think is really cool that you have this old, like, you know, Kmart, bygone corporate era building that is now being reused for some really cool local vendors.
What's the other one in Aurora on Colfax that is multi-businesses?
Mango House?
Mango House. Yeah. Yes, that's so cool. And I love the repurposing of these box stores.
Yes.
I saw a picture of the La Plaza in Westward, and it's so obviously a former Kmart.
Yeah.
But this new thing is like, I want to see it for myself. They were talking about it like, it's a like a village. That's what someone made a metaphor about in that article.
Yeah, I think
like,
the developer, that was his concept. Mm. And I don't know much about him, but from what I've heard, you know, it seems like it's a very genuine project where this person has like traveled and seen these mercados and wanted to bring that experience and have the people doing it actually Latinos. And it's really diverse. Like there's Colombian food trucks, Venezuelan, you know, and they bring in a lot of food items that you don't usually see here in Colorado as often, like these like long tacos you can get in Mexico City called machetes. Mm-hmm. Like they have those there. And I'm like, oh my God, this is like bringing all of that here and
so
giving
cool.
like, yeah, these people who are, you know, to share that that cuisine and culture with people. So I love this place. Everyone go.
Great win. Great win. I got to check it out. All right, my turn. Gosh, I got two here and both happen. You know what? I'm going to talk about both. I'll do one quick. I broke my rule and watched a regular season hockey game earlier this week, and it was a good one. Nathan MacKinnon scored this beautiful hat trick. He's the Avalanche, like, superstar center. I think he's going to win the Hart Trophy this year. I think he's the MVP of the league because he just crossed 50 goals. The team is on fire. They're cruising for the playoffs. They look great. But okay, the other one. Mayor Johnston, this week, he announced a new plan for smaller budget cuts than he expected to pay for Denver's newcomer response. So part of that is that they're reinstating rec centers on June 7th. DMVs are going to be back at their full strength. So different city departments are going to end up having to go through budget cuts as a result, like an average of 2.5% cuts on these different departments. But the thing that I was really keyed in on was the flower beds, because that's what we've been talking about with these budget cuts since he first announced them, was that there was going to be no flowers in any park beds this year in Denver. Now, unfortunately, we seem to have missed the timing for those flowers. He says that some flowers are going to be planted. But what I think is a win was this quote from Mayor Johnston. He says, "They're also looking at ways we use this as a chance to adapt to maybe new, more native species we'll have in these beds going forward."
But that's still things that you need to plant and buy and plant.
Well, buy and plant now, but I think the win for me is that it's a little less water intensive.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and
yeah,
also, we might not have to plant them every year.
Yeah.
They could come back and be just as beautiful and maybe even more beautiful. So that's my win. And that's the end of the show.
I love this. Thank you for having me. This was so cool.
Thanks for joining us, Lauren. And thanks as always, Justine.
Thank you.
That's all for today here on CityCast Denver. Our producers this week were Olivia Jewel Love, Dylan Brogan, and me, Paul Caroli. Peyton Garcia and Adrian Gonzalez write our morning newsletter, Hey Denver. Bree Davies is our host, and we hope she feels better soon. Our music is by Los Mocochetes, with additional mixing by Tyler Lindgren. If you haven't already, subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, follow us on Instagram at CityCast Denver, and tell Xcel Energy CEO Bob Frenzel about us the next time you see him. You can sign up for that daily newsletter I mentioned and learn more about us at denver.citycast.fm. And hey, don't forget, sign up to be a member today for your chance to win free VIP tickets to the Wine Spectators Grand Tour.